Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And welcome to Extreme Genes, America's family history show, and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And I got to tell you, this show today is just covering a lot of ground. Coming up, we're going to be talking to photo expert Ron Fox. He is back talking about a new source that's going to help you ID photographs and perhaps date them as well. And later on in the show, we're going to talk to a lady who was a rookie researcher, had never, ever tried to research her ancestors before, and she decided to take on a challenge that had baffled experts for 20 years, and she broke it. How did she do it? What was the story? You're going to hear that from Carol Burr later in the show. And just a reminder, by the way, all of our shows are now transcribed. So when you hear something and you want to follow up on that, all you have to do is search it with Extreme Genes in brackets, and you're going to be able to find it much more easily than ever before. And right now, let's head out to London and my good friend, David Alan Lambert. David, what are you doing in London?
Well, right now I'm trying to get the best Wi-Fi signal possible to talk to you so we can talk all about genealogy and the exciting Who Do You Think You Are live conference in Birmingham, England.
And you're going to be there for the next 2 or 3 weeks, right?
I'm actually here for all of Who Do You Think You Are. I will be doing a tour we do in London, going to the Society of Genealogists, the Public Record Office, the London Municipal Archives. And then I decided to take my comp days and spend an extra week in London touring the museums, going to the Tower of London, where some of my ancestors met their own demise. Just having a great old genealogical time, going up to some ancestral places up in Cheshire. So I'm really looking forward to it. It's genealogist holiday.
Oh, it sounds like it. What a great time.
It's amazing. There's just so many stories I'll be having for the next couple of weeks and potential new guests for you to interview on an international level. We're exposing Extreme Genes on a level that has never been done before, and it's really exciting. And I'm learning all these wonderful stories now. I've seen some people in their tartans. The Scottish are rich in their tartans and their history. But now I've heard the story that a gentleman by the name of Rabbi Mendel Jacobs, who's a rabbi up in Scotland, is authorized and has now got through the Scottish Tartan Authority an actual tartan for those that are Jewish.
Really?
Yes, and the interesting thing about it, because it has to meet kosher rules, so it's non-wool linen mix that abides to Jewish law prohibiting the mixture of wool and linen in garments, and it has navy and burgundy. It's quite colorful. Other exciting news, a tell-all book from a Russian princess who was potential bride for Prince Charles at one point before Diana. This lady who lives in England, her name is Olga Romanov. She lives in an opulent 30-room manor house in Kent called Provendore. Her father was the eldest nephew of Tsar Nicholas II of the Romanov Empire.
Wow. There's a little history there, huh?
Exactly. You know, I have some history on my phone. We always talk about photographs, and I went through the last time I was in England is in 1986, and I was going into my senior year in high school, and I'm in London for a lot of this trip, and I found a few photographs, took a picture with them with my iPhone. I have them on my phone, and I'm going to do a before and after picture.
Yes.
And maybe I'll share some of them with some of the visitors. I don't know. Sometimes the after pictures aren't as good as the befores, but it's a fun picture. I actually have curly black hair at that point in time.
Well, side-by-side pictures are fun to do, not only in other countries and places you've been, but your old home, like I did recently with my house that I grew up in. It went on the market recently, and we were able to take some of the MLS listing pictures and put them side-by-side with photos from 40 years ago. It's just amazing.
Well, that's my tech tip. So take an old photograph on your phone, and when the next time you're on a vacation or even going down the street, do a before and after picture. Put them side-by-side on your social media. You know, there's so many things that people are showing me here at the conference, but heirlooms, I think we've had this discussion before. What is important to save? I mean, right now in my jacket is my passport. That would be something that you would want to save. I even have my old one.
It's interesting you say that. There is a story out in the Huffington Post this past week. It talked about some ideas of things that you might want to save as heirlooms. And your first passport was on that list. In fact, it was the first thing on it
because it would show you when you were young and some of the cool places that you've been and shows what an adventurer you were. Then it lists things like your military discharge papers, one printed photo of your wedding. You know, maybe there are lots of pictures, but one printed photo, something that belonged to the oldest living relative that they knew. A sentimental piece of jewelry, a receipt with a date on it that shows how cheap things were back in our time.
Year by year, we get all as a family put together a time capsule, if you will, that represents certain events that make that whole year what that year has been for you. Good, the bad, the indifferent. And everything that happens to us is what shapes our story. And that's why I always thought journals were important. But this adds another dimension to it, is taking family ephemera into the picture.
David, have yourself a great time. We'll talk to you again next week. Where are you going to be next week when we talk to you?
I'll be still in London, and at that point in time, then I'll be heading up to Cheshire to a village called Brereton cum Smethwick, where my family lived from the time of the Reformation all the way through to the 1890s. I'm going to go to a family farm. I'm going to go to church services where my family has not attended since 1874, but we did for over 300 years.
Unbelievable. You have a great trip, my friend, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks so much. Take care, Fish.
And coming up next, we're going to talk to photo expert Ron Fox about a new source that's going to help you ID photos and date them. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, with my good friend Ron Fox, the photo expert. We've had him on many times before. Ron, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Scott.
And I was thinking about this. A couple of weeks ago, we saw the release of a brand new index. It's the New York Public Library Photographers Index. 115,000 photographers going back into the middle of the 19th century. And very significant thing, because this helps us in researching our photographs, maybe actually even identifying who somebody is based on the age they may have been when the picture was taken. And that you can determine by the location of a photographer from this index. Let's get into that a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a great, great research tool. And it's something that, you know, we had photography. It was introduced in 1839, came to the U.S. in about 1841. And then it was like wildfire, it was like Apple phones, you know, it just went crazy.
Yes.
And so we had a lot of people develop it. And our friend Samuel Morse is the one that really caused it to happen in the U.S. He's noted for the telegraph, but actually he's the father of photography. But the thing is that is most important about this index is if you find daguerreotypes, ambrotypes, and even albilums or paper print photographs at the bottom of most of your albilum prints put on cardboard or just photographs all the way up into the 50s, photographers always put their stamp on it because it was free advertising. And so you would have the opportunity to take a look at this index and see that this photographer, between a certain point in time, a certain year, and another year, was at that particular address.
Right. The address is usually on the photo, obviously, yes, with their name.
Yes. And by so, you would know that, say, that the photographer Bogardus, for example, was in New York on Broadway between 1851 and 1856, and then he moved over to Park Avenue. So you would know then a finite time in which he was using those particular photographic supplies to provide you with your photograph.
Yeah, and that can help you then identify the possible age of the subject or give you another clue in the event you have an idea of who it might be to know that it's in the right year range for the age that person should have been.
That's correct. And there's another book you can find in certain libraries, the collection of Western photographers for the Western U.S. It gives you a small bio, but it also tells about his movements and where he was. There was photographers that went on rail cars and would go to communities, and people would come into the rail car and have their picture taken, and then they'd get off.
Really?
Absolutely. It was a big business, and Union Pacific really used it after the completion of the railroad because it was another thing to bring people to the train station.
Nice. I'd never heard that.
You pull over the boxcar onto the siding and advertise it a day before. It's like the circus, man. It was coming to town.
And so you'd get ready and dressed in your best and go get your photograph taken. And then would they get that to you days later? Did they mail it to you? How would that work?
No, they would normally just be there for like 2 or 3 days. So you had an item that was there and you just had to go over and pick it up. But those days, tintypes were the cheapest photograph that you could purchase. Sometimes there were tintypes. Other times there were albilums. And even later, they had something called cinotypes, which are kind of fun because they are very rare and they are valuable. But they are photographs that are all in tones of blue.
I did not know that either. You're always a fountain of knowledge, Ron, which is why we appreciate having you on. All right, let's talk about some recent discoveries in the photographic world. You're kind of the king of finding the needle in the haystack.
Well, there's a lot of things that have been found in the last few years. There was a photograph that a friend of mine bought through a guy who was a picker, basically, in an antique store, and it was Frederick Douglass speaking in 1841 to a group of abolitionists. Well, he got it for $35. A very famous star has offered him $1 million for it, and he won't accept the money. He has it now resting in the Smithsonian, and they think it's one of the five most valuable historic photos in our history.
Isn't that incredible? For $35.
Yeah.
From a picker. I wonder if the picker knows about this.
I doubt it. I doubt it. It's just like my eBay fine. You know, that was a big fine.
And yes.
It's worth in excess of $100,000, which we paid a couple hundred bucks for. And it was just that you recognize the face and the name was not there. It was just a phrase about the guy, how he looked like an intelligent looking man. But there are other photographs. A couple of years ago, there was a small CDV, which is basically like a baseball card size.
And CDV is short for carte de visite.
Correct. French term. And of course, our friend Louis Daguerre, who was a main player in the process of coming up with photographs, but actually marketed it better and therefore had his name attached to it. But there was one found in Washington, D.C., where they had a group of people standing outside the White House, and they blew it up and recognized by measurements with geometry, it was President Lincoln standing out in front of the White House.
Really?
Yeah.
When was this found?
Oh, about 2 years ago.
And what's the value of that one?
Oh, that would rise that picture probably to $10,000, $15,000.
Unbelievable. And it's the only one of its kind.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people will not recognize, like, when they have a tintype of, like, President Lincoln. Not a phanerotype, which was a different process, but a tintype of President Lincoln, which was probably, again, a baseball card size, but it can go up to an 8x10, which would be a full plate, they call it. But they used to put a wood, like a bee's eye or a honeycomb, so each one of those little openings would go through the lens and take a picture. And therefore, you would have like 20 tintypes of one sitting. Of one
Yeah, that makes
photograph.
Sense. Sure.
And then they would just take tin snips and cut them up. And of course, we always talk about tin types, but they were actually steel, not tin. But those are actual photographs. If you get a photograph that's a tin type, unless it's a photograph of a photograph, that person stood in front of that piece of tin. So Lincoln stood in front of that piece of tin.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's not like a photographic negative where you can make multiple prints onto paper. No, a tin type is a one only type picture.
And it's always in reverse, is it not?
Yes. Yes. And there are practices. It was invented at one point because the early daguerreotypes were all reversed. But then they had a reversing lens that was invented in Germany, which they propagated over here later in the 1850s to reverse the reversed image.
Now, I have looked for some time for a lot of photographs of my family, my wife's family, by putting search terms, say, on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
She came from a small town in Indiana, Crawfordsville.
Right.
And so I would put the family name and Crawfordsville or Crawfordsville CDV, because maybe there isn't a name associated with a picture that's put on eBay. But this is what a lot of families can do to actually find old photographs, family Bibles, things
Absolutely.
Along like this. But you could go years also without ever finding anything. And then all of a sudden, after looking every day for 3 or 4 years, suddenly you find something new.
It's absolutely true. One of the other ones is that, you know, usually you'll have that print and you'll have that name at the bottom. Call the local public library or the university. And universities and colleges right now are spending tens of thousands of dollars a month on scanning old newspapers and photographs, and those are going online increasingly. Family Search is another good source. I mean, in the first year of operation, they had 1 million photographs.
And now I think it's many, many times
many
that.
Many times that.
Well, you know, you think about it. Some of the pictures you and I have worked on finding together, and I
right.
finally found a photo of my great-grandfather after 30 years, and now I have 3 of them because one was identified, which allowed me to identify him in a different picture, which allowed me to identify him in the third. The other two were not marked. And as a result of that now, after all these decades, we finally have it available, and you put it up online, and it's there forever because all the other descendants will make copies of that or keep that, or it will just remain up on the website.
That's right. And here's another issue. A lot of times you'll have a photographer in a small town like Crawfordsville, and you'll have the name of that photographer. And a lot of times you can actually do the genealogy on the photographer and find the family and ask them, where did all the negatives go? I did this recently with one family in our state, and candidly, out of it, I found that the woman's father, who took pictures from the 1890s to the 1930s, they're up in her attic. All these glass negatives, all indexed, are up in her attic.
Wow. And what an awful place for them.
Absolutely.
All that heat and cold and all that.
Absolutely.
So what are you doing with this?
Well, I'm trying to get her to sell them to me so I can scan them and so, or I can provide them to the state. In our case, the state loves this type of stuff and they will increase their archives to accommodate them. I mean, there are collections, like there's one collection I'm in, like 1925 in one of the major cities that has 22,000 glass negatives, all identified with prints as well as the actual negatives. And all you have to do is get online, put your name in, and up comes Grandpa.
Well, that's true. I actually found my grandpa in one of those collections in a state archive. That's right. Yeah. My grandfather from Oregon. And by the way, he was out of state at the time.
Yeah. There's also, as I said, these universities. I know of at least one major university that I've dealt with has over 2 million photographs that they have not even scanned yet.
2 million.
2 million.
And see, what you're doing right now is validating what I think, and that is with as much stuff as we have online right now, there is still far more stuff that is not online, that's still in archives, that's still in libraries, in people's private collections, in their attics, in antique stores, all over the place.
I really would encourage your listeners to take the opportunity to, one, get into that trunk and open it up and mark the photos that they know who they are, because 90% of the time, people do not write, even today, on the back of a photo, who it is. And one generation and it's gone.
You know, that is the best advice of all. Ron Fox, great to see you again. Thanks for coming on. Always enlightening. Always a pleasure to learn something more at your feet. And coming up for you next, we're going to talk to a rookie genealogist, one who said, as my first project, I want to take on a line that's baffled experts for 20 years. And she succeeded. Wait till you hear the story that Carol Burr has to tell you coming up next. And I'm very excited to be talking to Carol Burr. She's on the line with us right now from Utah County, Utah. Hi, Carol. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
And Carol had this idea in her mind that she wanted to find out about a husband's ancestor. And Carol, you've never done this before, right?
Absolutely. It was new territory.
New territory. I've been following this story, and it's just absolutely incredible. Now, your husband had an ancestor that came out to your neck of the woods sometime back in the 1860s. Now, what was his name?
Charles Berry.
Charles Berry. And where did he go?
He went to Moab, Utah, and that's where my husband was born and raised.
And so he had a lot of family members, I would assume, from that area. You know, large farming families, they spread out. So you probably had a lot of cousins who had worked on this line for some time.
Yes, and they were really eager to know more about him.
So here's the name Charles Berry, and he just kind of disappears into time. All these folks had worked on it, and you stepped up and said, hey, let me try. And so who did you reach out to help you with this?
I have a wonderful cousin that is in Oregon, and she does genealogy all the time and knows how the resources and how to do it. And she is the one that helped, and she basically was the one that led us to the right place.
Let's talk about this a little bit. It's a dead end for a reason. Obviously, they couldn't find anything that would link him. You know, when you do genealogy, you take what you know and you connect it to what you don't know. And there's got to be some kind of connecting document. And nobody could ever find Charles Berry before he arrived in Moab, Utah. What was the clue?
Well, the clue for her was the name of Bockrock. And we had heard Bockrock. He just didn't go by Bockrock.
So this is something that had been passed down through the family.
That's right. And so now this wonderful genealogist, as she was, she found a listing on it. And then she started searching for it. And then that gave me a lead also to start working on the same name.
Okay. And so what did she find? And what did you find?
Well, what I found, it's hard for me to even believe, even though there were many families with that name, I did find the name of the right person. And interestingly enough, it was in the library. It was just an old little book that they gave me, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing in front of my eyes. I started to cry my eyes out. In the back of the book, I found a whole Bach Rock family, and it was all names that we now could research even more. Without the Blue Book, it would have been probably a dead end for all of us. But it was wonderful because it had so many Bach Rocks, and they did have this specific line in the book. My husband's grandfather, this particular book, outlined that he lived in Moab, Utah. So they were giving us detail that is so tiny, and it was talking about all the families, who they were.
That's unbelievable.
And everything else just kept verifying it over and over and over.
And so you took this information and passed it over to your cousin, who's the expert, right?
Yes.
Who hadn't been able to do this in 20 years. And what happened with her?
Well, she was as excited as I was. And at that point, she really started concentrating on this particular line, going backwards and going forward. And you see, I'm not that astute. So she would tell me what to do. We had a lot of people to connect now.
Sure.
And so then we found out by our searching that there was a book written, and it was The Jews in Kestrage, and it was by the mayor. And I've learned that because in that Holocaust, they were trying to reconnect all the Jews they could that were taken and connect them to these towns. And so this particular name is The Jews in Kestrage. And so at that point, we had his wonderful book that was so great that we found, and we not only found the family, we found their grandparents and their houses they lived in, and even their dogs. It was a picture, I think.
Wow.
It was so complete and so amazing to us, and even into their cousins and the gravestones he had. And that's very important because that's more verification when you see those headstones with the names on them, you know. So, and then also there's a picture of grandmas and grandpas and their houses. And I just felt like all of a sudden we found this most amazing, wonderful family.
Isn't that something? After all these years, and here you are, the newbie who stepped into a family history library and pulls the book out of the shelf with a little help.
She was so much help. She would say to me, because she had all the links, okay, now you go. She would just absolutely say, now you go to do that, and you ask somebody to help you do this.
Right.
And it was so exciting to me, and it was so exciting to the whole family who had been searching. And believe me, they were searching. And some of them had become very, very close to finding it. And it wouldn't have to have been maybe in this particular method, but I'm certainly glad it was my experience, because now I feel very strongly about how the what the feelings are when you connect your family.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It is.
Absolutely. Now there was a tie-in that one of your cousin found in Baltimore, too, right? There was a museum that had posted a new book out.
That connected the name. It wasn't necessarily connecting him, but we knew then that this was a Jewish name. And then we also knew that there was a name which was such an unusual name. And so that's why she was hoping that she had really found that one family. But it didn't matter because we ended up finding another family with the right name.
Right. So it all tied together. So she basically discovered that this was a German Jewish name. And as a result of that, gave you a little bit more to work on. And then you found the little blue book in Salt Lake City. And suddenly you're connected back to Germany, where the mayor's written a book about the Jewish families that had once been in this little town. Unbelievable. How many ancestors would you say you have found now of Charles's from that far back?
Oh, at least 400.
Unbelievable.
And then probably more. We wanted to do it right, and we got it all of the connections, all going forward and back, as far as we could do that. We even called a family reunion, which I'd never even been in a family reunion with genealogy before. And we made it very clear that it would be better for them to go by Bach Rock, or you'll send someone down this goose chase again.
Well, you know, that's the thing. Once you find stuff like this, it lasts forever online, right?
That's right.
And so there you go.
Now, thank goodness, it wasn't before. But
what a strange journey, Carol, but congratulations on your find. I'm sure that almost makes your life at this point.
And also all the people that had gone on before me searching, and the time was right for some reason, you know, and it was time. That's all there is, because there was no excuse. I have 9 children. It's no excuse.
Well, congratulations, Carol, and enjoy the find. And I guess you're going to get to know a lot of cousins now who are probably very happy with you.
Oh, they were so grateful. And I keep saying, get the name Barry off of everything you have.
Exactly.
Like, even your checks, for heaven's sake.
Oh, you wanted them to change their names back, huh?
Oh, without a doubt. Other people would be searching, and the next 3 generations going to be searching Barry again.
Well, thank you for your time and congratulations.
Well, thank you, and that's a pleasure.
What a rookie genealogy story that is. Nice job, Carol. And it is Fisher here, your Radio Root Sleuth, and it's preservation time with our good friend Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. Hello, Tom. How are you?
Hello, Super Duper.
And I'm very excited to hear that you're starting to get more people bringing in audio to be digitized.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's exploding. We get calls almost every day now that their parents have passed away. They're going through the attic and they find these cassette tapes they didn't even know existed. Or they remember when they were little, listen to their old reel-to-reel tapes, but they don't know where they are until grandma and grandpa or mom and dad pass away and they find them.
Right. But some of these have got to be in pretty bad shape at this point.
Yeah. Unfortunately, like I mentioned, the ones in the attic where it gets hot and cold and hot and cold, it can cause a lot of the tapes to start flaking, especially the reel-to-reel. And don't worry about it. If you see they're starting to flake, don't throw them out. There's a way that you can actually bake the tape. And what it does is it softens the Mylar just enough that the magnetic particles reattach itself, and then you can play it fine. But you need
really?
To be careful. Oh, yeah. But you need to be careful, because if you play the tape before that and all the magnetic particles are falling on the floor, there's no way you can put them back together. It's worse than having something that's been shredded, trying to paste the pieces back together.
Boy, and that's going to be hard if you find an old tape. You want to play it,
yep,
right?
Yep.
But you got to resist that urge and make sure you get it to somebody who knows what they're doing with this.
Exactly. Usually it's sat there for 30, 40, 50, sometimes even 100 years of recordings. And it's best just to be patient, get them to us or somebody else that's a professional in the field, and then we can make your reel-to-reels and your audio cassettes come back to life. In fact, we just had a call the other day from somebody that says, oh, I've got this old cassette tape of great-grandpa. It's the only recording we have of his voice, and it's very, very hard to understand what he's saying. Is there anything you can do? Well, fortunately, there's several different things you can do. First off, you want to get it digitized. That's number one priority.
Right. And you can enhance audio.
Oh, absolutely. If you have a program like Pro Tools, Pro Tools is absolutely awesome. That's what we go to for most of our sweetening, as they call it in the industry. However, sometimes the tapes are so bad, it's really, really hard. You've got to get your ear right up to that speaker. You have to really, really listen to try to make out what they're doing. And so the best answer for that is what you want to do is go in and transcribe it. Put it on the paper for 2 reasons. First off, if somebody's reading along while grandpa's talking, even though it's hard to understand, you're reading the words, and then it magically makes it like it's more understandable when really it hasn't changed.
That's
true. That way you're hearing his voice, you're reading the words. And a neat thing about it is once it's in like a PDF form, you can go and look through it. You can type in the word Martha, and then every time he mentions Martha, there it is. So if you're fortunate enough that you have tons of tapes, you can go in and type in your name, and then any time that he has said that or she has said that, whoever made the recording, it's totally searchable. You can find Martha, 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 Martha. Then go read those paragraphs, and that's where he's talking about you or other relatives. You can type in any name, and once you make that PDF searchable, which with any basic PDF program from Adobe, you can do that. It makes it wonderful.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I've done exactly that. I've got some tapes of a grandfather of mine who was born in 1886. He lived till 1975. And we have a couple of really lengthy tapes. Some of the material is really fun to listen to, but a lot of it is, I don't want to hear that part. I want to hear about this. And so when I've gone through and actually transcribed, especially the more difficult parts to hear, it's exactly as you say. I can read along with it, and then I understand what I'm hearing so much better.
Absolutely. It makes a world of difference. And like you mentioned, when you make it as a searchable document, which is easy, once you have a PDF, all you have to do is open it in one of the Adobe programs that does the PDFs. And there's a little icon you can click on that says make searchable, or you just download the little typewriter and click on something and it will say, do you want to make this document searchable? And heck yes, push the button and then it's all searchable. You can look for what you want. You can go in and maybe make it more understandable for the people later on.
Give it some context.
Exactly. And that is so important.
All right. We've been talking about preserving audio, Tom, and giving it a little more context by not only digitizing it and enhancing it, but making it more understandable by transcribing it, actually like we're doing now with Extreme Genes.
Oh, exactly. It makes it so neat. We have people that call and say, or write us a letter and say, hey, you were talking about such and such. What exactly did you mean? So now they can go to Extreme Genes PDFs and they can actually read what we were talking about. Say, okay, and take notes and write down things. It makes it so much easier. So with your own family history, this is something you want to be doing also. So when you finally get grandpa or your parents' tapes transcribed and transferred and all these fun things, on the CDs that you're going to make or the MP3s, however you want to do it, what you want to do is go and add some of your own context because you know what was going on. You can explain, hey, grandpa was talking about this. We used to go there every summer, da-da-da-da-da-da. And a neat thing about that, it sets up the context. So when people are reading this, it's not like something foreign to them. It's something they understand. Oh, grandpa used to live here. And the neat thing about doing PDFs is you can go and get a Google map. Oh, this is what he's talking about, and this is what it looks like now. And so when he's describing our old farm with our cows and our goats, you can see, wow, it's a McDonald's now.
Yeah.
But sometimes the houses have been restored. If you have old photos, you can put those in the PDFs as well. And like we mentioned in the earlier segment, you can make these so searchable. And it makes it so much nicer when they're personal. It's not just somebody rambling on. They're sitting there, oh, this is grandpa talking about where mom was born. Like I have this story about my grandfather. In the old days, they didn't have incubators in the early 1900s. So they brought him home in a shoebox. They opened the oven door, turned on the oven, and set him on the door of the oven for warmth when he was a baby.
You'd go to prison these days for 30 years for something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly.
Wow.
But they didn't have incubators. He was premature. He was so small, he fit in a shoebox. They didn't have central heat back then. So they turned on the oven, and I'm sure it was low, and set him on the door just to kind of keep the heat. He was not in the oven. He was on the oven door. It was open to keep him warm. And he survived and lived a great, happy life. But stories like that are just so neat. And when you can put pictures to him, when you can go in and say, hey, this is what happened. This is kind of what grandpa's talking about. Because most people, when they're telling their family history, they know what they're talking about. So they leave out some details that maybe you're going, what did grandpa mean by this? What did grandma mean by this? But you being the son or the grandson or the granddaughter, add in some nuances to make it understandable.
And keep in mind, you'll often have a tape where the interviewer has also passed and doesn't identify himself or herself. You got to say who the person is actually asking the questions. And that's been the case for me. And so I've gone through and actually digitized tapes and then added an introduction at the beginning explaining when this tape was made, who did the questions, how old the people were at the time of it, and the context of that era.
Oh, exactly. That's what's so important about making them searchable. And like I mentioned, once you go in and make them searchable, you can actually add brackets with context. But it's so important you do these brackets and say, hey, see picture such and such on other document, or look at the VHS tapes we had transferred or the film we had transferred. It's over here. It's over here. So they can go, oh, I'm really interested in this. I want to go see that movie clip that talks about this. And so you can pull out your DVD and pop it in. Or if you use Heritage Collector software, you can just type in what you're looking for and it's totally searchable.
All right. Great stuff, Tom. Thanks for coming on. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. We'll see you then.
Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Thanks once again to Ron Fox, our photo expert, for talking about the incredible new index for photographers that can help you date your old-time pictures. Incredible stuff. And to Carol Bird, the rookie genealogist who broke open a line that the experts couldn't solve in 20 years. If you missed any of it, catch the podcast and search through the transcript. Talk to you next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.